got Chris Clayton, Chris Kelly, Ian Bundy, Joe Hickey, and also for the first time joining us is Ed House. So hello, Ed, and hello, everyone else.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Ed, you haven't been on before. So do you want to just say a brief bit about yourself and your kind of approach to photography and what you're up to? We do understand that you're not going to come on regularly because you've got other reasons you can't do that. But you're coming on today largely because we're going to be talking about something that is close to your heart, which is camera sensor sizes. So it's a special for you, for your input, really. But yes, do you want to say a bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm based in Suffolk. I got into photography quite a few years back with the Nokia N8, which is, I know it's a dirty word to say smartphones on this show, but you know, it was better than the compact I had at the time and sparked the interest. So from there I went to Panasonic FZ200 first, so got into bridge cameras and then from there the gas took hold and I went into Pentax SLRs, DSLRs, and then after a random sort of I'll give that a go purchase for, I think it was a combined total of about £170 for a GX7 with a little 12-32 lens, and after that I was like, no, this is good, I like Micro Four Thirds, I will buy pretty much anything if I can get away with it, but as you've no doubt seen in the group, but but I know I tend to, most of what I get is I tend to be focusing around macro and wildlife generally at the moment, but you know, I'll give anything a go if I catch the inspiration.
And Ed is active in our MeWe group, so don't forget to head across there. The MeWe group link is in the show notes, and it's also on our website, which is at tedsalmon.com/camera creations. So yeah, come and join us over there. There's also a link there to the Camera Creations shared album in Google Photos, where all the participants in the show will be dumping their pictures of the stuff we're going to be talking about on the show this evening. So lots going on, so do get stuck in, and we hope you enjoy it for the next hour nattering about cameras and photography, and not after now a phone to be mentioned. So we do start usually by just doing a brief catch up with whoever's got anything to say about what they've been doing since the last recording. So I nominate Chris to take us away on that one.
Hello, Ted. Yeah, I won't keep you too long. So I know Ian's had a busy couple of weeks as well. I didn't get out anywhere exciting, just my usual trips down to Brighton Beach. The pictures are in the group. So the first weekend, every Saturday morning, I try and get down to Brighton Beach, take a different lens each time just to see what I can get. I always go with pretty low expectations, and just if I can get anything, I'm pretty happy. But the first weekend down there, you'll see I got some nice storm clouds, purple hues. It was raining quite hard, so I just chucked a black mist filter on solely just to protect the lens from sea spray. But I think it did help the atmosphere, the scenes there, kind of diffuse light coming out of a purple sunrise, some pretty dramatic clouds. So I think there's like four photos I put in the group. I think the one that I'm most keen on is the bench angled down reflection. There's a bench in the foreground and a sort of dramatic sky in the background, and the black mist filters kind of taking the harshness out of the light in the sky. So yeah, I'm quite happy if I can get anything, to be honest. I never really go expecting much. And I got a couple there. So that was a couple of weeks back. And then last weekend, I took the drone with me. Hadn't flown the drone for a while and had even better skies, very dramatic skies. And yeah, there's a couple of photos in the group there. These are 9-shot panorama photos. So you've got the entirety of the sky, you've got the sunrise, and you've got quite dramatic rain clouds in the back. And for a small sensor drone, I'm really happy with how it's come out. there was a question in the group about how I do the stitching for these 9 shot panoramas. So the drone takes the 9 photos automatically, and it does give you a JPEG of final image, but I don't use that. I actually take the 9 individual raw photos that it captures, and I stitch them together myself in Lightroom. That way you get much better versatility with how you do the optical corrections, and also you can change the perspective yourself. So the DJI pano that it gives you crops out quite a large chunk, but when you do it yourself, you can keep much more of the final image, which is why you see on these pictures you get so much of the scene captured there. So I'm pretty happy with those panoramas. And also on that same day, about sort of 15 minutes after those were taken, I walked a little bit down towards the Brighton Palace Pier, and you'll see that there's a 5-minute long exposure. That was a kind of the edit I've done there. It's a little bit unusual for me. I would normally do a black and white edit for that because it's kind of dramatic skies with not too much colour. But as it was sunrise, there was kind of an orange glow behind me, and I've exaggerated that in the edit. And I've also kind of darkened the skies in the background. So I'm not sure what you guys think of that, but kind of took a chance with the edit. So open to feedback. But lastly, couple of drone shots over Brighton Marina. My favourite shot of the last 2 weeks is this very simple top-down sort of, I don't know what you call it, boat park. The jetties Marina, where the boats are lined up. Yeah, very simple, kind of minimal shot, but I really like it. It's kind of pleasing, it's sharp, and it's got a lot of contrast in the colour. And then there's another 9-shot panorama. You can see the entirety of Brighton Marina all the way out to Worthing if you pixel peep. So, yeah, 2 weeks, no special trips, but just some sort of run-of-the-mill Brighton photos that are okay. I think that's all I can say, they're okay.
Anyone, any thoughts?
Yeah, I like the edit. I was going to say, like, the colours match the Brighton sign and give some balance with the stones at the bottom as well. So, yeah, I quite like what you've done with that edit.
I would recommend anyone that sees it in MeWe to look at this Google Photos album, because it's so much... The colours, I don't know what MeWe's doing to the colours, but it's much more vibrant and much more crisp in the in the group.
I agree.
Yeah, but cheers, Joe. Yeah, I appreciate that. At least someone likes it.
I've noticed in MeWe just recently, whenever I put a photograph up, I get a message come up that says, this is too big, we're downsampling it. So at least they're telling you now.
I think they're doing something to the colour space or something, because right. The colours are going a bit strange for me when I upload things into MeWe. Yeah. But you get the idea.
Yeah, yeah. Anyone else, any thoughts before we move on?
Yeah, I mean, again, fantastic stuff. I love the drone shots. Those of the marina are particularly lovely with the turquoisey water from the top-down one. And I know I asked you the question in the group, but... that long exposure one, we had the bit of a conversation about the ND filters that you're using to get such a long exposure and having to stack them.
Yeah, so I've got a company called Case, spelled K-A-S-E. They do these overpriced, as everything is in photography, ND filters, but they're magnetic. So you can sort of stack them on top of each other. You can put sort of polarizers on top of ND filters, but this one was... I think it was 13 stops, so it'd be one 10-stop filter and then another 3-stop filter to give you a total 13 stops. And that was a 4.5-minute exposure there, which is about as long as I can be bothered to wait around, to be honest. But you can go, you know, if you do 16 stops, I think it was saying it was sort of 25 minutes. But
wow.
Yeah, it's a long time just to stand there.
Very good. Okay, Ian, you're next. He's gone.
No, hello? I'm back.
Is he there?
just following on from Chris's, I love the overhead of boats. I think that's epic. And again, similar one with the you did of the pier, which I really loved, which looked like an oversized lollipop, which was the end of the pier, which was really cool.
Yeah.
I think they would make a really good panel if you could get a selection in that sort of, for me, the colour, the turquoise really... brings it out, but I'm sure there's a collection or something you could put together on that would be really good.
Well, that photo of the pier, that is the photo that I've sold the most of on my website by quite a long way, which is ironic, really, because it's a tiny mobile phone sensor that sold the most prints. Well, the big 16 megapixel camera, you know, is lagging behind.
Something's telling you that, but yeah. So, I mean, I think a collection of those, that could be a sort of style. It does resonate definitely with me. And say that the overhead at the end of the pier was really, really cool.
I might add that in just so people know what we're talking about.
Yeah, to the photos group. Anyone else to see that? It looks really, really cool. So,
cheers in.
Really busy for me. Last couple of weeks, I was Silverstone. I managed to, first time this year in the overalls and helmet, to shoot the European Le Mans Series. So to be a photographer, you have to wear full race suit, fireproofs and a helmet to have access to the pit lane, because they have refueling on cars. So it is super scary sort of stuff. You have to have your eyes in the back of your head and stuff like that, because they don't stop and run you over. But that was a lot of fun. I took some images for an agency that focus on women in sport. And the main thing I was trying to do was focus on Jamie Chadwick. She's an ex, I think it was the
W Series.
Yeah, W Series, where she won. She's super, super talented. She does...
Multiple winner of it.
Yes. She does the co-coms on the Formula One as well for Sky. So I went there, spoke to this agency, said I could do a piece on her. And luckily enough, she won it as well, which was pretty cool. The fun bit for me was it rained as well, which is, for me, is always... add something to the photography, because it's, a lot of the time I come back from races and go, yeah, it's just a car going around a corner, but you could have some fun with the edits with that. And there was a couple of images. The one I was most happy with was one down the pit straight with a red and black car, the United Auto Sports car. I really like the edit on that. Did really well on, there's a sort of peer group on Facebook for motorsport photography. So it has a lot of positive stuff on that, which was nice to get. As opposed to Instagram, which my Instagram seems to have fallen off a cliff a little bit regarding the amount of exposure everything gets. It was getting up to sort of 300, 400 likes per image and stuff like that, and now it's gone down to one man and a dog. So I don't know what I have been doing or not been doing, but so that was really cool.
Just before you move on, Ian, can I, that one in the pits, is that in edit or is that a zoom blur?
So that's a zoom blur. So the one after that, there's it was in the pit lane. I wanted to play around with slow shutter speed. So I was doing a few which focusing either on the mechanics as the car comes in, so the car will be blurry, or focusing on the car, which blurs out the pit crew. This one here, I think it was down to maybe a 20th of a second or something like that, with the car coming out of the pit after being serviced. I can never get if it's good or not, because there's still, I hate having blurriness, but the whole point of the picture is it needs to be blurry. So
having attempted that many times, I'm impressed, because I know how hard that is, and you've actually got the helmet of the driver pretty sharp there, so while all the rest of it's going on, so I applaud you, sir.
Thank you. And probably the 2000 that went in the bin, which there was one in there. But
we don't talk about them ones.
No.
I was doing it with film, so it was like...
and that's really where the skill comes in. That I can only imagine the amount of wastage I get, but for having a certain amount of film in there... I remember having a chat with a photographer called Mark Sutton, who's really famous for motorsport photography. He's been doing it since the 90s. And he used to do film, and he did an iconic shot. I'll put it in the group, but he did one of the flying, it's called the Flying Finn, which is Mika Häkkinen with all four wheels off the ground. Yeah. And he was saying about how he took the image, that he took it on film, and he didn't know if he got it until the film came back. So yeah. It was this waiting process that he said, I think I got this shot, and I'm hoping it was sharp. And the resulting image was epic, because it was like a Formula One car flying. But having that wait until that the images come back must be quite challenging.
So I don't know if the rest of the crowd know what's going on in terms of controls, but you're zooming while you're panning, and in my day also manually focusing to try and get something like that. So you're kind of running three things all at once and rubbing your belly and patting your head as well.
Yeah, and again, you're happy if you get one out of there So I was quite happy with that. There was a portrait. I have uploaded a load into the shared folder. There was just a few that I was going to talk through. The other one was there was a mechanic. I've got this thing about reflections, and the reflection of the car in his goggles. To me, I really like those kind of shots, so yeah. I was happy with that one. I'm now at the point where I think I have to take a bottle of water out when I'm going to be taking photographs, just similar to Chris's one with the bench. There's nothing better than having some kind of reflection and getting a shot that way. So I went to Silverstone as a precursor. The last week I've been in Baku. I went to Azerbaijan for the Formula One Grand Prix. Did some work for a French agency, MPS, which was my first street race, which is super challenging because the whole of the track is in the city centre. It's like Monaco. So getting around, especially as a photographer, is very, very difficult. First one I was happy with, you've got the iconic Flames hotel and the rear shot of the car going around there, which was pretty good. But again, it was as an experience for me, it's always a learning piece. But also being so close to the cars, this is the fastest circuit on the calendar, and being so close to the cars as they're going round is quite a buzz. The second image, I was hanging out of a window, a photographer's window, to shoot Fernando Alonso, and how close they get to the wall is you just feel the wind as it's coming round, and you've got to have a little bit of bravery to stick your camera out there to get that shot. So that was quite an exhilarating and enjoyable experience, should I say.
I think that's a good point there, sometimes what you do to get the shot.
that's the memorable bit. I think that's the whole, I think for me, when you go out and shoot, I know it was similar with Chris, that it's that the experience of taking the shot and stuff like that, and how you get it is the memorable bit, more than the output. That was pretty cool, and again, very, very close and quite exhilarating. I've got a Porsche. I was in pit lane for FP3. There was quite an interesting girl who's one of the mechanics for Aston Martin. I thought it was quite an interesting shot of her expression, and she wasn't posing or anything. She was just, again, waiting for the car to come back in. I thought it was quite interesting. Nothing special about the image, but it was quite an interesting subject.
I like that one because it's quite alternative, isn't it? You wouldn't expect that alternative sort of looking lady to be in the pit. And I think it highlights that orange goes well with green.
Exactly. Yeah, and one thing about the track, it goes through the town and past the Gothic castle. Again, another hanging out the window with actually getting to use my wide angle lens for a change and trying to shoot the cars coming around the corner. Again, basically hanging out with the camera and shooting, which was quite fun. Probably my highlight for the weekend, got a good shot of Max Verstappen, him in the car. I was happy. It's probably my image of the weekend, to be honest.
Of getting,
yeah, I was just going to say, and that is probably the best photo I've seen you post. It's fantastic. It really is.
Unreal.
I don't know if it's because it's Max Verstappen or, you know, if it was someone else there, whether it had, but it's just, it's like he's looking through your soul. Mm. It's, you've got him staring right down the barrel of the camera. And I love the way that you've got the, I don't know what you call it, the halo thing that they have kind of framing him. It just works so well. It's definitely something you'd see on the front of a motorsport magazine or something. It's a really terrific, that image.
It's definitely one of those situations where less is more. I think the fact that
you've
only got the one eye actually adds to it rather than getting both.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I don't think it would be the same. I did get some shots of other drivers quite close, but I don't think it's the same when you've got the whole of their face. But I think it's because he's looking dead on, whereas they were looking slightly to the side. But I was happy with that. But I always go away. You compare yourself to other photographers, and there is some really talented people out there. So I always come away after this. It's sort of 14-hour days. It's really hardcore producing images just for quantity. So you lose a lot of the artistic flair that you would like to put into your photography is sort of lost a little bit, and you turn into a bit of a machine just to get images out. So but I think a few of the images were sold, none of these ones, but there was it's normally just a car shot that they use for a web page or something like that they they'll sell. But epic experience. And lastly, I managed to get to Southwold today. Went out there with the wife and the dog and actually took the camera and had a play around with a little edit on some beach huts. Nothing special or anything, but it was, again, it's just making sure that you go out with your camera and not taking something with your phone so you can compose it a little bit. So I just highlighted the red hut compared to the other beach huts. Again, nothing particularly special, but it was nice taking the camera out. So that's me waffling on for a bit. So that's what I've been doing the last couple of weeks.
Okay, thanks, Ian. Good stuff indeed. Joe, you're next.
Yeah, I had a feeling that the other chaps would have been out a lot, so I didn't go out with my camera. I did, however, I'm filming unboxing of an iPhone with my new 50mm lens. Thought I'd give it a go with that lens, and it came out all right. I thought it came out quite nice. I am on annual leave at the moment, so I will try and get out before the next pod, I promise.
Okay, CK.
Yeah, the only camera I've used this week is the my Drift Ghost 4K XL. Trips off the tongue, that, doesn't it? Which is the video camera that I have strapped to my helmet when teaching motorcycle students trying to commit suicide. So,
and anything to report on that?
Just if you want to watch some scary videos of people trying to kill themselves on motorcycles, I could share those with you.
Well, there's a whole YouTube channel there.
Yeah,
there's probably a business thing there.
Very good. Okay, right, Chris Clayton. Over to you now with rumours and news.
Okay, fair amount. So let's crack on. the big rumour that's just broken, my old friends at Sony Alpha Rumours, is the Sony A7 V is finally being leaked. Long overdue. This was meant to come out earlier this year, but with all the tariffs and whatnot, sounds like it was delayed to the back end of this year. So we've got a rumoured October, November release date. This is the successor to the A74, arguably the most successful mirrorless camera of all time. So this is going to be a big deal. When it came out, it was the go-to camera in a kind of £2,000 to £3,000 range. This is the camera that you would buy. It was just the obvious choice. I think Ian had one, I had one. But in the intervening years, they've been sort of lapped. Nikon with the Z6 III, way faster, cheaper. It's a better camera all round, really. And even the Z8 isn't much more money, and that's an absolute beast, which Ian has. So they've got a lot of work to do. But the rumours don't suggest that they're going to do that work. The sensor, it's a 33 megapixel, which is the A74. Whether it's the same 33 megapixel, we're not sure. There's rumours that it'll be semi-stacked, like the Z6 III, which would be a big improvement to speed, but that will be the detriment to dynamic range. But we'll wait to see on that. And the pricing, rumoured at $3,000, which I think is probably a tough pill to swallow. Not much of an upgrade over the 4 to warrant that price. And if you're coming into a new system, you'd probably rather go Nikon. I think I would, for the value. But we shall see. October, November release date. I don't know if anyone else has got any thoughts on the A7 V.
Well, the only thing I was going to say is Sony feel like they're a bit like Apple in the mirrorless camera world. They always feel like they could do more, especially for the price point they have. But they don't give it to you. But they know people will buy a Sony anyway, so they don't care. That's my thoughts. I don't know what people think on that.
Well, I think you might be right that they are resting on their laurels, but I think Nikon has kind of surged over the last couple of years, so I'm not sure that's going to really work out long term for them. But I know Ian jumped from Sony to Nikon, so I'm not sure if he's got any thoughts on the 5.
No, I mean, I thought the 4 was good. Again, I had the A7 Mark III before that, and one thing I noticed between the Nikon and the Sony is Sony's a lot more compact. With the Nikon, you know you're carrying a camera with you, which is challenging. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see how it goes, and it'd be also interesting, maybe some research there, some work for one of the pods on how the main manufacturers are going regarding sales. I know for motorsport camera, Canon are probably the big ones that are there. Canon Professional Services are at all of the media centres. You get Nikon occasionally and maybe Sony, but it'd be interesting to see where the sales are compared to sort of Nikon, Canon and Sony, really, and where the direction they're going.
It's hard to nail down the numbers. You get these headlines like Canon has the highest market share, but then it's like of the entire industry and just mirrorless or just full frame. So I think if you sort of drill down the numbers, I'd imagine Sony would be up there for full frame mirrorless, but I think Nikon must be catching up, especially the last couple of years.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. So Sony's more fashionable. I think for me, when I moved from my iPhone to getting a proper camera, it seemed like get a Sony. They're the ones that people are shooting with and stuff.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I did. Mm. Well, I think I got the A7 IV because I saw your photos here and I thought, well, if you can get those kind of pictures, then
wonder what I could do. Yeah.
No, I mean, they were that good. I was thinking, well, you know, this is what it's capable of. That, so you know that it's going to do a good job, and it does. But I think once you sort of get more into it, you realise that it's not really all about that, is it? It's about other things. But
yeah,
you often see Sony people in stores as well, so they get pushed in stores, I feel. Like when I visited Park Cameras, I saw a load of Sony people in there before driving sales on there.
I guess they got the backing on the entire electronics company, haven't they, rather than just Canon or Nikon. But we'll see. A couple of months, we'll find out more, hopefully. Last rumour is a long-awaited successor to Sony's macro, first-party macro lens. They've been selling a 90mm 2.8 for 10 years. So long overdue. This one will be 100mm, and so Sony 100mm 2.8 GM lens. The GM is significant because GM is the red badge of the Sony lineup. It's their most expensive range. All it means to me is this lens is going to be very, very expensive. I think the current one's about £800. I think this one will probably be double that, bearing in mind it's newer and it's a GM. The last one was just a G, so we'll see. But for macro users, I think this is going to be a stellar lens.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, I think it'll be a great lens. The f-stop's great for macro because I'm actually hoping to get a 100mm f2.8 Lumix lens for my birthday, funny enough. And I've added a link to Micro Four Nerds. I don't know if you guys have heard of her. She's really good.
Yeah.
I've linked an article, and she's saying how it's quite a versatile lens as well for portraits and live concerts as well. But yeah, nice lens, I think.
Do you know, I know it's going to be a present, but do you know how much that Panasonic, the Lumix one cost, the 100mm?
I'd have to quickly have a little look.
Well, that would be too much.
I might have looked at it earlier today, and I think it was about £950 on Wex.
Okay, so it's got comparable with the Sony one that they've currently got. Mm. But yeah, I think this GM will probably eclipse that by quite a fair margin.
That stands for G-Master, does it?
Yeah, G-Master, yeah. But then they do... the range down from that is just G, which I found to be just as good optically as the G Masters, but they tend to be a bit slower, normally F4 lenses.
Okay, Chris, we got quite a lot of news to get through as well, so can I just politely speed you up a bit, please?
Yeah, hurry me along. Apologies. Okay, so the big new release is the DJI Mini 5 Pro drone. Big upgrades over the Mini Pro 4, notably the sensor. It's a 1-inch sensor. Which is, I think the last one was a 1 over 1.3, so it's a fair improvement on that. Improved obstacle avoidance, improved wind resistance, and it's quieter. So doing all that and still hitting that 250 gram cutoff point is kind of an engineering marvel. Definitely a drone that I would want to get, but I can't really justify what would be near £1,000 for sort of 3 or 4 pictures a month that I'd probably get out of it. But if I had that cash lying around, I would definitely jump on. Just a very quick addendum to that. There is a bit of controversy about the weight. Most people on the DJI Reddit are reporting this weight of the Mini 5 Pro coming at 253 grams, putting it 3 grams over the light drone limit. And there's quite a lot of ramifications to that. You can't fly near people, you can't fly near buildings, 150 meters from buildings and 50 meters from people if your drone is over 250 grams, and you also need an additional flyer ID drone license that involves tests and handing over money. So that is something to watch. Quite a lot of controversy in the DJI community about the weight of this drone.
Surely they'll bring it down, won't they?
I think they'll have to, because if they don't, I mean, the weights are self-certified. DJI say on their website, if you go onto their website where they sell this drone, that it's a 249 gram, but there is a 4 gram under or over, which I don't think it's going to cut much muster. If you get a job's worth copper with a set of scales on him, he could do you. And he would be legally... Well, he would be legally entitled to do you if he wanted to. So this is kind of a big deal. I think it could be if they don't bring this down. So I'm hoping that in later batches that they can bring this weight down, because it has caused quite a furore in the groups. But we'll see. Mm. Okay, we'll move on swiftly.
Who's the lens? Before you do that, there's someone that says they've got a Neo. Who's written that?
Oh, yes.
That's me. So I've got the cheapo DJI Neo, and it fits in the camera bag just as for the cost of £115 it cost me, but it still doesn't get much use even if I carry it around with me. So, but it's nice to have there. It doesn't have the quality that Chris's has, but it's nice to get the odd shot with. So,
Great
well,
fun.
I have to declare an interest too. I've also got a Neo, which I bought from Kev Wright, and I've not even taken it out of the box yet. I've had it for months.
Yes. Okay, Chris, back to you.
Okay, quick Panasonic, they released this very day a new telephoto 100 to 500 f5 to f7.1. This is £1,800 and will weigh 1.3 kilograms. This is a good focal range. Normally these first party telephotos are 100 to 400, so you've got an extra 100 on there. And they've kept the size down, 196 centimetres, so it's 15 centimetres shorter than Sony's 100 to 400, although it is half a stop slower. But for a kind of very versatile, I wouldn't say budget, but at £1,800, it isn't the price that some of these telephotos go for. I think that's a good deal. Panasonic user, Joe?
Yep, I want it. I like the fact that it's not as heavy as some of the other options. I watched a couple of videos before we came on, actually, and Josh Cameron, he does some really good content for Lumix. And I've added a link here for his video. And it gives a bit of a glowing review, really, a first impression. It also seems like it works really well with a teleconverter as well. So you can get some extra zoom on it.
Do you remember if he mentioned the variable aperture, how that stopped down, how quick it stopped down?
He did mention it, but it seemed to perform really well. But yeah, I was just like thinking I want it. So I wasn't paying too much attention, but it seemed to perform really well. Because I watched another, I can't remember the guy's name now, it's something Wong, I think it was. He gave a glowing review as well. He said even in video, like the stopping down of the F stop, you don't notice it too much. It's quite smooth, which was quite good.
It's good that Lumix are bringing out these first party kind of high end lenses and at a good price as well. So them sort of filling out that L mount range even more, which is good news.
I'd save up those still.
Yeah, nothing. Even the cheap lenses are definitely not cheap, are they?
No.
So just follow on quickly from last week as well, we talked about the Sigma 20 to 200 on that same day that we just missed when we recorded. Tamron conveniently happened to leak their Mark II version of their travel super zoom. Their current model is a 28 to 200, but this new one will be a 25 to 200 and a 2.8 to 5.6, which is in keeping with their last model. I think this would have given a lot of users pause for thought who are looking at the Sigma, because the Tamron is very highly rated. The aperture's a lot quicker and it doesn't stop down, or at least the Mark 1 didn't. It doesn't stop down quite as quick as the Sigma does. So I think this would be a good option. I'm assuming it'll be about £800, similar to the Mark 1. Tamron Super Zoom, keep your eye open. Joe, you've written on the notes here that you fancy something like this to sort of give a go.
Yeah, I would like to replace my kit lens, which is 20-60. So that sort of 25-200 is the sort of thing I'd be looking at, and I get more idea of what focal lengths I like. And the hybrid zoom that my camera has would be great with that as well.
Yeah, I don't know. I always think 24-70, a Sigma for your length, for your body, would be a good option. It's very, very high quality lens, the Sigma 2.8. I think it'll be a similar price to this super zoom, but everything's a trade-off though, isn't it, in photography?
Yeah.
Ed, do you feel free to jump in when you want to? Is he there?
Ed?
I saw him muted. Writing. I saw him writing a note.
Sorry. I don't tend to shoot very wide very often, which maybe we'll come on to later as why one of the reasons Micro Four Thirds kind of suited me. I still think if I was spending money on those lenses, I would go with the wider one and take the flexibility even over a 2.8 lens, because just that'll probably stop down quite quickly. And being able to shoot wide when you need to, it's got to be better, isn't it?
Well, 20 to 25 is quite a big difference, so I would be tempted to agree. And I don't like Tamron lenses, but that's another story. I've got to be in my bonnet about Tamron. But anyway, we'll move on. Lauer, latest lens release from Lauer, is a 180mm f4 macro lens. This is priced very competitively at just £500, and that is available on E mount, Z mount, L mount, and Canon RF mounts. But the drawback on this, and why it's probably so cheap, is that below 1.5 meters, the autofocus doesn't work. So basically, macro images will need to be focused manually. I'm not a macro shooter. I know there's a couple here who are. So is that a big, as big a problem as I think it is?
If I, I'll jump in first. For me, that would be a massive no-no. Because I don't have the time to set up a tripod. Most of our walks are like, most of the time when I get to shoot macros, it's if we're out on a walk as a family, and it's like, right, okay, I've got get a picture in focus as quickly as I can, one shot, no tripod, just you know, no messing around with it. So to sit there and you know, to get an 180mm lens focused on something at macro distances is
it's gonna be shaky as well, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's gonna be no way to handhold that. I can't imagine it's a particularly light lens either. Big macros don't tend to be, so I think that'll probably that'd be a tripod lens, and I don't have time for that.
See, I like manual focus because it's great fun to shoot manual focus, but it is all about time, and just like Ed, I don't really have much time. But when you have more time, it's nice to dial in with the manual focus, I think.
I think it's a nice experience doing it for something large, but if you're trying to use it in macro, I don't know, maybe I'm a little bit too spoiled in the modern age, but I genuinely find it frustrating because you're talking about things like where you move a hair's distance and then the bit of the insect or the flower or the whatever goes out of focus because the focal plane is so tight. I think it would just end up with one of the, whether the lens, the camera, or both end up in a nearby river or lake.
Well, I struggle. I've got the Sony 70-200, which is macro, so it says it's macro. But even with the autofocus on that, as you say, the depth of field is so tiny, even if you're up to like f8, that just tiny movements and you've completely blown out the whole thing that you were taking a photo of. So manual, that's a total deal breaker for me. But I'm sure someone will buy it.
Yeah, I've dropped some images that I took with a Nikon D7000. It was quite challenging. Not great.
Yeah.
You can see, but...
Yeah, I see it's back focused on a couple of them.
Yeah, it was very challenging, but it was good fun.
All part of the fun, isn't it? So the last story of any interest is the another Lauer story. We talked about the Sigma 200 F2 a couple of weeks ago. Lauer now have priced their version of the 200 F2. So the Sigma was $3,300. The Lauer is going to come in at under 2,000, still waiting on UK pricing, and this will be available on EZ and L mounts, but not RF Canon mounts. But I mean, that's a massive saving over the Sigma, and I think this is quite a niche lens, so people will be using it for sort of sparingly. I think it makes way more sense to buy this Lauer at 2,000 or the equivalent UK pricing than the Sigma $1,300. I think that's going to be quite a good lens and a bit of a bargain in a couple of years. That'll probably be down near £1,000 used, and then you can pick one of these up and have a lot of fun. I don't know if anyone else has got any ideas on the 200 f2 from Lauer.
Well, the only thing I added was that if 200 mil was a focal length I ended up shooting quite a lot, this would be one to keep an eye on. I think
it's a heavy boy though, Joe, this.
Yeah.
I think it's like 1.5 kilograms or something.
Yeah, that's why that other lens that we spoke about earlier is quite good.
yeah, it's going to give you a lot more versatility, but so it's always a trade-off, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very last story of the week is a Lauer, little camera from Kodak. Can someone say this for me, Kodak?
I think it's Charmra.
Yeah.
Charmra?
Yeah.
Charmra, right. I think so.
Yeah, that's what I read it as.
Right, this is like a key ring or something, is it?
It's a little camera, it's a tiny little camera that's a 2-megapixel thing, and apparently all the Japanese people are buying them up, and they're selling like hotcakes, and it's actually a bit of something and nothing really. It's a bit of a retro, it looks a bit like a 110 camera from the 1980s, and I think that's probably the general idea. But yeah, it's essentially a tiny little keyring camera, which as we know with the Japanese folk, they love these kind of cute gimmicky things, and they're selling out all over the place. So not for us probably on this show, but
no, well, not for me definitely, but I'm sure someone will find a use for it.
Could have been fun. Could have attached a little smartphone macro lens to it and see what little things you can get it into. Yeah. Being a tiny little camera.
Yeah. Joe, in its defense,
well, it's cheap. £30.
Yeah,
it's cute and charming, you already mentioned that sort of thing. But is it for real enthusiasts? No, of course not. It's an expensive keyring, basically. We won't be changing our name to Charmer Creations, that's for sure.
I've noticed this is a trend. It's a bit of a thing that I've seen, especially in the motorsport side, that taking the disposable cameras and taking shots with those. There was a guy... was with over the weekend, who had his wife's Fuji Insta Mini, which was in bright pink, which is one of these instant cameras that comes out with a Polaroid and you have the image straight away. And he was the fun thing. He was taking pictures over the weekend and puts them in a scrapbook and to document things, but the images were awful. it's more the tangible thing, but all of the images were really poor quality. And I guess you would have the same. It's just that thing that you would probably post on Instagram. Look, I took this picture from this camera, and it's rubbish, sort of thing. But I don't know.
The only thing I think that sounds up Instagram good for is it for a little gift for a little one, like their first little camera, maybe.
Well, apparently people have taken these little instant photographs and sticking them all over their fridges, and teenagers are all giving them to each other. You had a thought, Ed?
Yeah, I'm just for the fact that it's £25. Yeah, fine. Be something new to play with. See what you can get out of it. It's something to explore. But then, as you all know, I'm not averse to buying something weird just to see whether it's any good or not.
Very good. Okay, and my last one is the £120 GF2 bolt-on flash for the Ricoh GR4 and most of the other Ricoh GR models, actually. It's really cute. I didn't know they did this. And another reason to consider the GR4 when I win the lottery. Because I used to love using my little flash guns and slaves and stuff back in the day with photography. And I used to just find that the flash photography that particularly Nikon gave me was just so clever. The fill flash and the curtain sinking and the whole flash photography thing. I'm sure CK, you'll agree with me on this. It used to be just we moved away from flash photography just to a large degree for normal photographers these days. But back in the day, I used to get huge enjoyment from flash. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think I mentioned previously when I did my personal biog. One of my heroes was Martin Parn. He did his New Brighton series, and he used fill flash, but he used it stronger than you normally would. Mm-hmm. So it was really bright, and he went for picking up primary colours. So rather than just sort of filling in shadows, he was really using it as a creative tool, having on camera flash. So I certainly used to a fair bit of that.
Yep.
Is that a first party, Ted? Is that from Ricoh?
Yeah,
that flash?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and that's why it's 100 and actually it's not 120 quid, it's 167 quid.
Right, I was gonna say that seems cheap for Ricoh. Yeah. Charles Winston on the group, he's got a Ricoh GR3 and he's done street photography with a flash. Maybe get him on one time, but he got one called like I think it's Q-Pix. I think it's about £100 on Amazon, but he got some really good results with the Ricoh and a flash. Yeah. So I think you can get good stuff with that.
I'd love to. If I had the Rico body now, I think I could go a bit mad with extension lenses and all sorts of... There's an optical viewfinder, which is...
Yeah, they got a lot of accessories.
Yeah, it'd be really good fun. Ed, before we move to our main part of the theme for the show, you had one more thing to add?
I was just seeing there's rumours around and potential of a cut price Leica M11, the M11V. An M11V with no rangefinder, but with EVF and a simpler design. Seems like the rumours are they're cutting a few of the specs. I somehow doubt that the ensuing discount would make it cheap enough that I'd want to buy it, though. It might not be quite enough, but they do all look lovely, and the results always look lovely. But I'm not sure. I think I need to win the lottery first, and then you'd just buy the proper one, wouldn't you? But they obviously think there's a market for it if that's what is coming.
That's not a fixed lens, is it? This is
no end mount.
Yeah, so you might get the body cheaper, but then you still got to buy lenses.
Three grand for a 50mm prime.
We'll put a link to that in the show notes anyway, just for sport. Let's move on, because we're almost an hour in now, unbelievably, and we need to get to our theme of the show, which was, does sensor size matter? And Ed's been patiently waiting there to get his defensive Micro Four Thirds in, and Chris has been waiting patiently to also talk about his anti-Micro Four Thirds and full frame.
That might be an exaggeration.
Let the fight begin, and let's talk about, Chris, you can lead the way and then Ed can pick it up. Tell us all about why sensor size matters, or why sensor size doesn't matter.
Well, it does matter to me. I am kind of an optical maximalist, I think you could say. I just want, if you're going to buy a camera, I want the best camera that I can buy, that I can afford. I want the best image quality that I can attain, which obviously is as much as I can spend. And I think the benefits are kind of speak for themselves. All you've got to do is look at Ian's photos today. There's no way you'd get any of those pictures with a Micro Four Thirds, with the compression, the image quality, the depth of field. It just speaks for itself. You know, the rendering is fantastic. The lenses are better on the whole. If you get high-end Micro Four Thirds lenses, you're spending more than you would on full-frame lenses. In some cases, I think Olympus have like a telephoto that costs like $9,000, which is absolutely crazy. for me, it's just about getting the very best image quality you can over all other things.
Okay, so I think I'll start out of the gate with you. I don't think it matters what sensor format you use, as long as you know what you've got in mind to use it for. Because I'm fairly certain there are cameras fast enough with probably enough resolution, because for most stuff we don't need single frame ultra high resolution. Appreciate that's the one thing you can't really do on Micro Four Thirds. That is its Achilles heel, if you like. But the... you know, if you wanted to do motorsports, you've got cameras that have equally high frame rates to the, you know, the Z8, the whatever the Sony equivalents are, the A1.
Well, you wouldn't get anything. The A93, you wouldn't get anything that's going to come close to that from anybody.
Well, I think in terms of frame rates, I don't know. I haven't checked those because I'm not a, as you might have gathered, I'm a bit of a I'm a tightwad camera collector, not a not a professional with a professional budget, but I know the higher frame rates are, you know, I think there's 60 frames per second shooting full raw on the high-end OM bodies. I don't see how you could need more than that. I don't see how your SSD storage would cope with that. I think you'd just end up with more. Maybe Ian can comment to this, but I think you'd probably end up with more photos than you could actually professionally use in that situation. But maybe I'll stay out of the bit that I have no idea about using them professionally. But from my point of view, from a macro point of view, the bigger the sensor is, the harder it gets. So I can shoot at F4 quite happily and get sort of, you know, larger things like bees and wasps and have some, you know, still have some shallow depth of field, but still get most of like a head in or something. Earlier in the year, I had a little experiment with buying I bought the Sigma 105 for my old Nikon D3100, which admittedly doesn't have the best resolution, 14 megapixels on a very old, very grainy, noisy sensor, but get some decent results out of it. But then I had the opportunity to try a D610, so full frame, 24 megapixels, plenty of resolution, fairly good, right, if not quite up there with the current crop of cameras today. But apart from very situational, almost gimmicky photos where I was playing with the shallow depth of field, apart from that, the fact that I'd have to step it down to F16, F22 meant that I was getting less sharp photos from the D610 than I was from how old is it now? The EM1 is probably 12 years old and 16 megapixels, and not even as good as, in terms of like pixel performance, I think the GX7 is actually better, and that's just as old and that still has a, what they call it, the filter for the Moire filter. So that's definitely not as sharp as it could be, but I was getting better results out of those cameras for what I was doing. And I don't really see, with things like, you know, street shooting or landscapes, general sort of enthusiast photography, if you like, I don't see what full frame actually offers me. Because if I'm going for high resolution, I can, you know, you can, if I was really bothered about high resolution, I could buy one of the bodies that has the multi-shot high res modes for doing landscape, or again, you know, doing cityscapes and stuff like that. But the benefit I get in most cases, there are probably edge cases, but in most cases, they're a hell of a lot cheaper and a lot lighter. So, you know, if you look at like a typical the equivalent of you can have a 600 millimeter f4 on Nikon Z. I think I've put my links the wrong way around. Apologies, I'm confusing myself.
Yeah, okay.
You can have a 600 millimeter f4 Nikon Z, and that's going to cost you £11,000 used. I'm looking at used because that's what I buy. I don't buy new. Where there was an option to buy used, I've gone with those prices. So it's £11,000 new. Used, and it weighs 3.2 kilos. And the equivalent, which is a 300 millimeter f4 on Micro Four Thirds system, is 1.2 kilos. And £1,500 used. That's quite a bit more attainable for me.
Yeah, but I wouldn't say they are equivalent. I would say an equivalent would be a 600 f8. I know the apertures are the same across sensor sizes. No, I know they don't, because no one would buy a 600 f8. No one would buy a full frame and then put a 600 f8 on it, because it's pointless.
But when you think about the use cases, the use case for that lens is generally you're going to want reasonably high shutter speeds. If you're using that for birds or, you know, other wildlife at a range, going to want an f8 because of that. But you are going to want, you know, if you can have an f4 at 300, that's better. And you're probably going to not be worrying too much about the depth of field that you might lose going from f4 to, you know, an equivalent of f8.
But for birds, you're going to really struggle with ISO because you're going to need a high shutter speed. And I think obviously it's diminishing returns, as anything in technology is. And it's like where you draw the line on what compromises you're willing to make. But I think there's going to be a huge difference between a 300 f4 and even a 600 f8 on full frame in terms of image quality.
There was a good video actually which explored this. One of the guys on the group, Adrian, shared and basically it came down to, yes, there is an image quality difference. You can see it. It's there. You know, even on similar resolutions, it's definitely there. But the question is then, how much do you actually need that difference? If you're doing professional shooting, then, you know, maybe you do. But
I think we need to delineate between need and want. I don't need any of the stuff I have.
No, nor do I.
Use my phone, really. So,
yep, we're in the same boat there.
What we need to spend on what we want. And I am one of these sad gits who gets home and I do press the 800% zoom in button and try and read a sign a mile away with my 60 megapixel camera. And I think, oh, isn't that nice? And obviously no one's ever going to see it except for me. But
I do think there's a case to that, though, that actually a lot of that sharpness is the lenses you've got. You've got decent lenses. Those pictures would look sharp on your A7 R5. They'd probably also still look sharp if you put on an old A7, you know, back on whatever that was, 24 megapixels. They'd still look sharp then because they're good lenses.
Yeah. And this has been my issue with APS-C on Sony, is that all the money goes into the full frame and the APS-C lenses are compromised. Whereas the Fuji lenses, you know, they put all their money into them. So they're better, in my opinion, than the Sony APS-C lenses. But if you want the best glass on, I don't really know enough about Micro Four Thirds, but all I know is Olympus have put all the money into the glass, but you pay so much for it. It is still
cheaper than, well, from what I looked at a few examples. So again, like a 70-200 equivalent. So, you know, standard, as I'm told, not that I've ever been one, but a standard, you know, for professional photographers type lens, you know, you've got a 70-200 on Sony. So 2.5K new, they didn't have any second hand ones for me to compare the prices on. 2.5K new nearly, and weighs a kilo. So you know, that's still fairly light. The old digital SLR ones I think were probably slightly heavier than that. But the Olympus one brand new is 1.2, and actually I didn't include on there. There's a promotion at the moment, so you can get that for $1,000 and it's still 25% lighter.
I'd counter that and say the 70-200 f/4 Sony lens, which I own, is about 1100, and I think that's going to give you, I mean, noticeably better images than an Olympus would.
I think, again, I suppose it depends on what you look at for image quality. So I've shared a few in the group this week, like a couple from a gig I went to on Tuesday, and I look at those and I don't see any lack of sharpness. I see that, and that was, these were taken with the base level, so not the pro version. Bearing in mind, again, like whatever it is, 13-year-old camera, and the base level 45mm 1.8. And I was focusing on keeping the shutter speed right, but I was letting so I was on the shutter speed priority and keeping the you know, letting the camera do the rest. And most of the time it's sort of fairly well wide open. And I say, I'm not seeing any lack of sharpness there. But then,
I was just looking at the pictures, and I've done some gig photography and they're super sharp. Yeah. And so what camera are we using for that? And what lens?
Most of those were the GX7, which, like I say, is, you know, aging now. It's it's barely just about holding itself together. I've had to rebuild the viewfinder once, but the Olympus 45mm 1.8, so the, which you can get for about, I think I bought mine for 120 quid off MPB.
Wow. Yeah.
So the camera cost me £91 because of the condition it was in. So
yeah, you can't really argue with a bang for buck down at that that kind of price, for sure.
But and I think if I wanted to print these out bigger, all the detail that I want in that picture is in that picture. I don't want the pause of the people in there. They don't want to have the pictures.
I want the pause, Ed.
No.
I want the pause.
No, I would want as much as I could afford to get in those images. I must confess. Yeah. I'm with Chris on that.
If I wanted to print those, and that resolution doesn't go high enough for me to print that at 300 dpi, I'd just use an upscaler to smooth it out so that you don't see the pixelation, because the detail is still, the details that I want are in there. I don't think there's any benefit to those pictures to having any more resolution there.
The best image you got there is the one with the white lights kind of forming a triangle.
Yeah.
That's the best image. I really like the composition. I think it's got a great kind of contrast. But I think that image would be improved if it was taken on a larger sensor. I think I can see in the metadata is at ISO 1600, and it looks quite noisy, and all the details lost in the singer's face. I think that would have been improved with a larger sensor. So I think for low light there is obvious benefits, but again, you do have to pay for it.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying there. But I would say actually you're already seeing more than you could see as a person at that gig. At that moment in time, his face was completely in shadow.
Yeah.
So I do like my pictures to be representative of reality as much as I can. Maybe I should whack the contrast up a bit more. But actually, I think my best photos, the ones I like the most, are actually ones where the limitation of the camera comes in. So, I don't think would be as good if those rays of light were any better defined. If they were less blown out, I would say that would detract from the image, because those lights were bright. They need to be bright in my mind.
Whenever I look at a photo, I'm always thinking, how would I edit that? And then obviously you get a lot more to edit with.
I'll send you the file. I look forward to seeing what you do with it.
It's just the way, I think it's just how you look at photos and how you work with them. I would do this or I'd do that. And obviously knowing you've got more information is always going to be beneficial when you're editing. I mean, it's a great photo at camera, obviously, but that's another advantage.
Let's take the example of the foyer, Ed. So you've taken a couple of photographs. These are in better light, and they're not of a moving subject, and it's not really, really dark. So maybe the two of you could have a quick look at one of those between you.
So I know that area very well. Sorry, Chris, talking over.
That's all right. No, it's fine. You go, Ed. You go, mate.
I was just going to say what I did here was literally just with the JPEGs, because I've only been home a short while this evening, but I just took the JPEG and boosted it, so made it brighter so that it was a bit easier to see what detail was packed away even just in the JPEGs.
Okay. And Chris?
I was just going to say, I can tell that the shadows have been raised. You can see a lot of noise in the shadows. Because I know that that's quite dark where that picture was taken. I've taken a few pictures there myself. And again, you're going to get a lot more shadow recovery on a large sensor, way more than you're going to get on a smaller sensor.
We can generally get about 3 stops before it gets terrible. That was just on, if you're using the RAW, but that was obviously just on the...
On the JPEG.
Ian, any thoughts to jump in between the two views here?
I love seeing the gig photography, because I've always tried again to find a way to smuggle my camera into a gig, and I managed to get my Sony into a Gary Newman concert as well, which I was super happy that I got it in the crowd and had a proper camera, not my iPhone. But I don't go down to that sort of technical level, I must confess, and I would just want to have the very best that I could get to try and recover as much out of the photo as possible. So the quality of the photos I've seen from Ed, with what he shot it with, is super, super amazing. But I would always like to have something better to get more out of it, I must confess. But that's just me. So
I suppose that's also my luxury, isn't it, Ed? Ian. I'm Ed. that's my luxury as a hobbyist. I'm only thinking about what I want out of the picture. I'm not really thinking of selling. I don't even have a thread to put these things on anywhere. I just do it for my own enjoyment. So if it's blown out and no one likes it, I don't care. It's just for me or my memories or my amusement of the moment. I wouldn't want that pressure.
No.
I don't think I could handle it.
No, that's fully right. And I lose a lot of the pleasure out of photography. And my favourite pictures are probably the memory. And again, all the way back to what we're talking with Joe at the start, is that memory of taking the picture, I think for me is the fun of photography and getting representation that you can see the image in your head afterwards as well when it reminds you. But
capturing a memory.
Yeah. There's a tagline there somewhere, isn't it?
It's a Kodak moment.
Yeah.
There's a difference here between at one extreme we've got Chris's near OCD levels of wanting to just get as much as he possibly can out of any image, whereas Ed's view is very much as a more hobbyist kind of, this is where I was in this concert and this is what I saw and that's what I want to remember. And there probably isn't any right or wrong answers here. The different benefits and pros and cons of what we're talking about are probably, Joe, let's have some thoughts from you, because you've added some notes here, quite a few notes about your thoughts on the whole topic. So what do you reckon?
Yeah, I won't go too far into what I've written, so I don't want to overrun too much, but I think it's horses for courses. Like, when we live in a world where some people like to add grain to their image, which...
That's me.
Yeah, so would it matter if you had full frame then or not? But yeah, I was seriously debating before I got my S5 II of getting a Lumix G9 II, which is 4/3. And there was loads of reasons why. Some of the things that I'll quickly go through, like it has really great stabilization, like amazing stabilization. So for handheld long exposures, for vlogging, stuff like that, it would have been superior to the S5 II. The S5 II is no slouch, but it would have been better. The electronic shutter is amazing. It's a little bit lighter as well, and obviously the lenses are lighter, so getting, and obviously with crop sensor you can get further zoom with lighter lenses, which would be great when I go to the zoo. So that was my thinking of potentially getting the G9 too, but ultimately I ended up getting the full frame. People like Chris was in my ear saying I should get the best quality. And to be honest,
definitely,
because of I want to do video recording as well, I wanted a really good hybrid. The built-in fans for the S5 II was a factor. There's less noise, especially on low light, which is good for both stills and video. But I mean, my level probably wouldn't have mattered which camera I got, if I'm honest. But what actually came down to it was price. There was a really good deal on the S5 II. It was actually much cheaper than the G9 II. I got it for $1,099 for the body, so it was a no-brainer in the end. But I could have happily bought either, I think. They both have the same body, just a little bit difference in weight.
Do you think you'd have appreciated the bigger sensor, though, in any way in your life?
I think potentially, yeah. I mean, I'm not very good, so I have to recover quite a lot sometimes in my edits. So, yeah, I probably do appreciate having that bit more data in the RAW files. But in saying that, there's loads of benefits of Micro Four Thirds there. Especially if you're doing wildlife photography, it can be a really great one to have. There's a lot of people that favour that. There's a channel I love, which I've mentioned already. She's called Micro Four Nerds, and I highly recommend checking her out. She does really great stuff.
Okay. All right, so there's no easy answer. Last word to you, Ed. Any final thoughts before we wrap this up, because we're well over the hour now?
It's not a defence of Micro Four Thirds. It's just a defence of use whatever if you think you can do it. I think that's more my position. They're light and easy for me, but I got on very well with APS-C before and could quite happily do again if I decide to go down the Fuji route or anything else. But is Chris saving for medium format now?
Oh, if I could, I'd be walking around London with my Hasselblad XD2. I would but unfortunately it's slightly out of my price range. But.
And then it'll be a 5x4 plate camera.
Yeah.
Perhaps we should we'll do a lottery syndicate between us, and then we can all get the cameras we want.
Yes. Right, okay, thanks ever so much, Ed, for joining us. It's been great to have that debate, which has been a long time coming. Thank you all for joining me as well. Chris Clayton, Ian Bundy, Joe Hickey, Chris Kelly, and as I say, Ed. We will be back in 2 weeks' time with another one. The website is tedsalmon.com/camera creations, which is where you'll find all the stuff we've been talking about and links, and also the Camera Creations shared album link in Google Photos, where everything we've spoken about today should be in that album for you to look at while you're listening in your podcatcher. And if you want to join us in the MeWe group, you can do that. We'd love to see what photographs you've been taking with your proper cameras and not phones, so do head across there. And yep, we'll be back in a fortnight. Thanks all for listening.
Bye.